We're back with Dr. Gary Wills, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. We have had many very interesting conversations that go around and are iconoclastic, breaking icons. And one of my favorite many years ago was with James Carse, who has written a beautiful little meditation that he calls The Gospel of the Beloved Disciple. And he maintains that having taught the history and philosophy of religion for many, many years at New York University, NYU, he maintains we all must write a gospel because you don't know what you think until you write it down, and that whether one is Christian or not, in the Western world, in the industrialized world, that it has had such an impact that one needs to write one's own story of what Jesus meant. Well, with the gospel of the beloved disciple, he posits that the beloved disciple is a woman, which, as I read what the gospels meant, is not all that implausible. It does change some things. Yes. Women in the early church and in the experience of Jesus of Nazareth were a very important part of the process and were not shunned the way or demeaned the way that a fundamentalist perspective does, a misogynist perspective, puts women down.
Well, the beloved disciple is a kind of technical term. In the Gospel of John, it's their tradition, and he's masculine. He's referred to in the masculine. But women were extremely important in the early following of Jesus. Of course, there were women all around him, women at the cross. But the first writing that we have is Paul. And Paul refers to women as his co-workers, which is his term for Timothy and the others. There are no priests. He doesn't call himself or Timothy or anybody a priest. He calls himself an emissary, but he also calls a woman an emissary, an apostolos. And he says, he refers to six women as his co-workers, co-evangelists. And one of them saved his life. One of them went to jail with him. And one of them he calls an apostolos. Junia was her name. Well, she became a saint in the Orthodox Church, Greek Orthodox Church, and she had her own feast day and sermons preached to her by John Chrysostom and others. But in the Middle Ages, this patriarchal, misogynist church that had grown up since then, and a priesthood that had grown up, which didn't exist originally, they decided, oh, no, we cannot have a woman apostle. And so Junia is referred to by Paul in the Gospel of the Romans in the accusative case, which is Junia, but with a different accent than the nominative. Actually, if you had a male name, it would have been Junias, and it would have had the same accusative, but with a different accent. So they just changed the text, and they said, it's not Junia, it's Junias. There is a male apostle. The trouble with that is that it is a male form, but it's one that was never used. There are no Juniases in history. There are plenty of Junias.
But again, it's the ability to step back and use scholarship, to use what we know, the accreted knowledge, the wisdom, that you can say, oh, they changed it. That doesn't make it right.
Right, exactly.
And for me, that was really quite a wonderful experience. Having been named Paula, I have much of my life really resented that I carried the name that was associated with a misogynist. Well, No,
he's not at all a misogynist. partly that's true. That's from the fact that only seven of the 13 letters of Paul are authentic. And the one that they constantly quote to Timothy, women shut up in church, is not by him. Now, one by him was foisted into another of his gospels to reconcile it to that. But the same one that it's foisted into, in that very one he says, when women prophets are prophesying in church, they should wear veils. Prophet is a high calling, and she's doing it in church. So he's not telling women, shut up in church. It can't be. So the whole idea that he was a misogynist or that he was anti-Semitic is part of, it's based on so many misunderstandings. What astonished me when I went out with what Jesus meant is that they were saying, oh, the Gospels are wonderful. But along comes Paul afterward and distorts them and makes up his own religion and that kind of thing. It didn't occur to them that he wrote first.
Which is historically accurate.
Yeah, right. He's writing the 40s, 50s. They're writing the 70s, 80s, 90s.
This goes to a core concern to me that, you know, a lot of people, you know, faith is very confusing. A lot of people think that all they have to do is have faith, and that is sufficient in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. And it seems to me that because faith is so central to a religious perspective in general and to certain types of people in the Christian tradition, that concept itself warrants unpacking. You do it in bits and pieces of what I've read, but it seems to me that's a very important piece of the current instantiation of religion.
Yeah. I talk in a book called Head and Heart about evangelical and enlightened religion. Enlightened religion does not exclude reason. It doesn't limit religion to reason. John Locke, who kind of set up the rules for enlightened religion, said there are certain things that are against reason, and we have to reject those. There are certain things that are beyond reason, and we can't reject those, and that's the realm of faith. As long as they're not a contrary to reason, they may be believable. But of course, some evangelicals say that if you try to apply reason, you're attacking faith. I had a woman, I was out talking about my current book, and she said, "Do you believe in the inerrancy of Scripture?" And I said, "No, I believe that God is trying to tell us something, but he's not talking in terms of obstetrics or astronomy. He's talking in symbols."
And he's not doing it in the King James Version of English.
Right. he's talking in symbols, so it depends on your language. And she said, "Then you're denying the sovereignty of God and putting reason above God." So the idea that reason is inimical to religion, that you have to reject, for instance, evolution, is very important to the evangelical concept of faith. A different concept of faith is the Anselmic, that it's faith out in quest of knowledge, not denying knowledge, but out in quest of it. When Augustine says we have to use our reason and our revelation, that's a tradition that... and so the best people in our history, it seems to me, have combined the two. They've been people who knew about the laws of nature and nature's God, and also knew that a religion of the heart is something that goes beyond reason. Lincoln was that way in the second inaugural. Cesar Chavez was that way. The Quakers, who were abolitionists in the 18th century, were that way. Dorothy Day was that way. The Berrigan brothers. We've had a lot of A.J. Musty, a lot of great prophets who were not at all unreasonable. They were very, very open toward science, toward progress, toward enlightenment. And yet, America has been strongest when those two can come together. When they're separated, they become the... Enlightened religion without the heart becomes etiolated, becomes all light and no heat, becomes too ethereal. And of course, religion of the heart without reason becomes all heat and no light. So what we should hope for and strive toward is a combination of the two.
You tell a wonderful story, and it puts this in the political context as well as the spiritual context, which is the story of your engagement with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Chicago, and the lessons you draw from that.
Would you repeat that story?
Sure. When the Dalai Lama came to Chicago, he spoke at the Field Museum, and he said, "I don't like to give talks because they're too boring, and I go to sleep in the crowd goes to sleep, so I like to have somebody on the stage with me who would challenge me with questions." And I was one of the ones who was asked to do that, and he said to us before, "Don't be too deferential to me. Some people treat me too nice, and that doesn't produce anything. Ask me hard questions." So on the spur of the moment, it's hard to think of anything, but I did say, "What would you do different if you went back to your country?" And he said, "I would disestablish the religion because the American system is the proper one." And as we were going out, I said to him, "For that, don't you need an enlightenment?" And he said, "Ah, there's the problem."
And you meant enlightenment in terms of the intellectual tradition.
Right, the 18th century belief that reason has a sway. And his very next book said, Buddhism has not come to grips with modern science, with rationality. And America did.
Which he's working very hard to correct, I might add.
Yeah, exactly. So he's trying to get to where we started. We had the blessing of having a beginning of a religion, of a country. And it was the first country. It was the first country that had no official god and no official cult of that god. And that is the only original thing in our Constitution. Everything else in it, federalism, bicameralism, tripartite administration, judicial independence, had all been around in theory and practice. The only thing it hadn't been is separation of church and state. And of course, a lot of people attacked that and said, how can you have a Constitution that never mentions the word God? But Jefferson and Madison have both said, this is the best thing could happen to religion. And of course, it's turned out to be true.
And Gary Wills is qualified to tell us that. He has a few more minutes with us when we return. We hope you'll be with us.